Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a Northern Border conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Northern border, as in the 5,500 miles between the United States and Canada. Shortly after the November election, President Trump threatened tariffs against Mexico and Canada in order to secure the U.S. border and crack down on fentanyl. And seemingly, instantly, there have been attention to the problem brewing on the northern border. President Trump has a knack for stirring things up and getting action. And on January 28th, ABC News reported Royal Canadian Police have launched Black Hawk helicopters along the border in Minnesota. Drones and fentanyl detection has also been deployed. A special shout out goes to my friend Bob Harkins, retired DA agent and now teaching professor for a master's program at San Diego State University in a special Homeland Security Initiative program. His students are assigned a High Truth podcast to summarize, and at the end of the year, I'm invited as a guest to their class. And each time, I ask the students, what else do you want to hear about? And they wanted to hear about the northern border. And so here we are, and this episode is dedicated to them. Our nation has been focused on the southern border with Mexico, but things have now attention at the northern border as well. To learn more about the northern border, I reached out to Sheriff Mike Milstead. Mike Milstead began his law enforcement career in 1973 with the Sioux Falls Police Department of South Dakota. In 1997, he was sworn in as sheriff of Minnehaha County, where he has served for over 27 years. Sheriff Milstead is on the board of directors of the National Sheriff Association and is the chair of its Drug Enforcement Committee. Sheriff Mike has served in roles for the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and other three-letter agencies. To learn more about Sheriff Mike Milstead, check out the High Truth show notes. Sheriff Mike Milstead, welcome to High Truths.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. This has been a special commissioned episode, so there's other people anxiously waiting for our discussion as well. But you're a sheriff, and tell us about choosing a profession in law enforcement, and especially to young people today considering such a career.
Well, you know, I have kind of a unique path. My father was a state trooper in South Dakota, highway patrolman, hired right after World War II. So that tells you how far back my family goes in law enforcement. He served an entire career on the highway patrol and was captain in Sioux Falls, which is the biggest city in South Dakota. When I started on the police department in Sioux Falls, and I worked there for over 24 and a half years. I was on the drug task force, the HIDA drug task force, as a supervisor and then the night shift commander for the police. And I had an opportunity to seek the office of sheriff. And so I've been sheriff in this county, Minnehaha County, most populated county in South Dakota, which in many states would be a very small county, a little over 225,000 people. But in South Dakota, with only 800 and some thousand people, it's a pretty good sized county. And so I've been there and in this position for 28 years.
That's great. And so it runs in your family all the way back to World War II, your dad, you. What about children? You have kids who chose that?
I do. I have a daughter that works in public service, public safety. And then my son is a sergeant and on the opposite end of South Dakota, where the Black Hills, Mount Rushmore. He's a sergeant on the sheriff's office out there, so it is certainly a family tradition. My brother-in-law was a deputy sheriff as well. So, yeah, my brother worked as a reserve deputy. So, yeah, it does become a family thing, but we're learning more and more that individuals, especially young individuals wanting to serve, seek public service. It's a very rewarding idea for those that have never had it in their family, but felt that they wanted to serve in an important function in America. Law enforcement is a great place. In particular, I'll be selfish and tell you that South Dakota, we were one of those states that defended the police. We didn't defund the police. And so we have a strong support for law enforcement here. We have great communities. It's one of the best places in America to live and raise a family. Our crime rate is low. We have very conservative values here. And so, but even nationwide, we're seeing it's more and more difficult to hire people that want to come into the law enforcement profession in particular, because quite frankly, we've been beaten up for a number of years, and it's impacted, how many people graduate from high school and college and say, I want to go, strap on a gun belt and a uniform and go through extensive training, and then, be under the scrutiny of when I stop a car, three people, instead of jumping out to help me, will be jumping out with their iPhones to try to film and see if I do anything wrong. So there's been some transition. It's a little more difficult to recruit good staff, but we're making really good progress, in particular with a lot of the up and coming leaders in law enforcement. And quite frankly, I will say with the, I'm personally feel a significant comfort with the new administration coming in, that I think will be very pro-justice, pro-law enforcement, pro-law and order, pro-public safety. And so those are things I'm looking forward to. And I think people, especially young people looking to start a career, there's probably not a better time than now to consider that as an opportunity.
Yeah. And I know you're not just saying that because your kids followed your footsteps as well. And it is a sacrifice because you people sacrifice their life as well to protecting people. So, Sheriff, very basic question, okay? But I bet you a lot of Americans don't know, but what is a sheriff? What's the difference between a sheriff and just a police officer?
Well, I mean, let's use my own community as an example. Sioux Falls is a little around 200,000 people, and the rest of the county, we have probably 30,000 people, but it's all within Minnehaha County. So you'll see my sheriff's cars patrolling the city streets of Sioux Falls, right side by side with our partners on the Sioux Falls PD. The difference is, decades and decades ago, when they wrote the law, in particular on sheriffs, they added a lot of additional duties to the office of sheriff that aren't traditionally held by local law enforcement or police departments or the highway patrol. So sheriffs execute all the civil processes. So we serve protection orders. So those deputies may be looking to serve a domestic protection order. We serve writs and warrants.
Wait, what is a domestic protection order? What does that
domestic
mean?
Domestic protection order would be a court order served on an individual that abused his or her spouse or significant other that they've lived together. And it virtually is a you can't go near this person, you can't contact this person. If you do, there's a mandatory arrest by law enforcement. So it's to try to protect that person from being harassed or followed or intimidated by oftentimes an abusive, somebody that was abusive in their relationship. So once they're served with that, if they violate any condition of that, it's a mandatory arrest by law enforcement. So we serve all of those papers. We serve judgments and executions. So if somebody didn't pay their bills, or they didn't pay their credit card, for example, and they're taken to court and they're say that there's a $2,500 garnishment on their wages, we have to go find their employer, garnish their wages, take so much out of each check. So it's a lot of civil process. And in my department, just in this area, I have about nine people assigned to our civil division, and strictly they're working on those things. If somebody's going to be evicted from their property, well, we have to go through that whole eviction process, post notice. We have a quit and vacate. We have an order to leave. And then we have instances where the person just refuses to leave. We have to physically go with deputy sheriffs in, whether it's in Sioux Falls or out in the rural areas, and physically remove them from that. So all those duties are listed under the responsibility of the sheriff, not under the responsibility of a municipal police department. And that's pretty standard nationwide. And so we have great respect. We have a great working relationship with our police department and our troopers here in Sioux Falls. We're housed in one building. We share. We don't duplicate our services. So we have one dispatch center. We have one crime lab. We have one jail. I operate a jail. It's about, currently we have probably 550 inmates in the Minnehaha County Jail. It's not a responsibility of the city, even though it's the biggest city in the state. So sheriffs just have a lot more responsibilities. We're responsible for securing our circuit courts. So if you go to the courthouse, the front security and the courthouse security are all deputy sheriffs. We have a unique situation in our Air National Guard base here in Sioux Falls, where we provide security services with 16 deputy sheriffs out at the Air National Guard. So it's just, we also contract as a local police department in all of the cities in our county, except for two, Sioux Falls and Brandon. So if you go to any of our rural communities, they don't have their own police departments anymore. They contract me to have deputies there as their municipal police department. And it really works out well for us. It allows us to have more deputies out in the county, but also provide these cities services without having to try to keep and maintain officers. Quite frankly, these very small departments in rural areas struggle to keep people, struggle to keep good people, because if they get a really good officer, I'll probably hire them away. So, and I could pay more, and we have more resources within our department. And I'll just touch on one other thing, as our partnerships and our HIDTA task force, which is the high intensity drug trafficking area designation out of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. We have a HIDTA task force here. So it's our drug enforcement efforts in South Dakota, in particular in this region, are through our HIDTA task force. HIDTA funds a number of our officers on the task force. But our task force, if you went back in my office, the drug office right now, you would see men and women from the ATF, DEA, Homeland Security Investigations, deputy sheriffs, city police officers, and the State Division of Criminal Investigation, all working side by side, addressing the drug issues in our community, our state, and our nation. So it's a multi-jurisdictional drug task force. Very effective way to deal with the drug problems that we have in our community, which we are not immune from.
Yeah. HIDTA is important, and I think I told you the story about that was my first encounter working on safe prescribing back when prescription opiates were the problem in our country. HIDTA, a group of law enforcement officers, came in and said, we want to fund this program. I was surprised, and that's because their purpose is collaborative. But, you know, the other thing I learned about sheriff, I think I learned from you, is that the sheriff is the oldest standing office of the entire United States, being around since the Constitution, and the highest ranking officers in any area.
It is. It's a very historic office. It comes from, you know, way beyond that, over into England and France, and back then, of course, it was the Sharif, and they were also tax collectors. Now that in Louisiana, the sheriff is still the tax collector also, in addition to all those other duties that I explained to you. So yeah. They have that additional duty. But if you look across the U.S., and I work, I'm on the board with National Sheriffs, so I get to interact with sheriffs all over the nation. But a lot of those offices are, they have a lot of duties that I guess, quite frankly, nobody else wanted. And they're really critical to being able to properly serve the public. And like most sheriffs, we're an elected office. I have a county commission, 5 members of the county commission. They have the only thing the county commission has authority over the sheriff is the power of the purse. Now, that's tremendous power, right? They control my money, my budget. But I have a great county commission. I've been fortunate for over 27 years to have really good county commissioners. They don't micromanage my operation. Our statute is clear that they don't have the ability to tell the sheriff to do anything, but they do have the power of the purse. So I work together with them. I have a liaison with the commission, but they don't get into my business. I serve the people. I answer to the people.
And you're elected by the people?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that makes also a big difference that you're elected for the people. That's who you answer to. And that gives you creativity to actually get, problems solved.
It was really unique for me to come from a long career as a city police officer, where if the chief wanted to make a change, if it was something that impacted, you may need to run it by the mayor. They may need to run it by the city council. We have a great police department and we've been very fortunate there. But I do hear of other places that really struggle with that, the ability to do what's best for the people, because of it could be in another city. It could be that the mayor wants to try to run and micromanage the police department. In the office of sheriff, you don't have that. You do what's in the best interest of the people. And what was really nice when I came into this job was to be able to make changes that I thought was the best in the best interest of the citizens, and do it at a moment's notice. I don't have to ask anybody, right? Every 4 years I go up, I'm up for an election to see if they're okay with the decisions I'm making. But I have something, the street in front of my office is Minnesota Avenue. It's a very busy street in our community. And I have the Minnesota Avenue rule. All my staff knows that. And that is, when I'm faced with a decision, my staff knows that I want to do 3 words, right? The right thing. So I said, now I always consider what the right thing is it legal? Is it backed up by state statute or the federal law? But then if I was to stop the first 100 cars coming down the hill and have them all pull in the parking lot and get out on the hoods of their car, and if I presented them the problem and said, here's what I think the solution is, or here's what I'm going to do, would they tell me that's the right thing? So that's a nice thing, is having the ability to just do what you believe the people want you to do, serve what you're, based on your experience, and to be able to make those decisions without asking Captain May I of someone who's never worked in law enforcement.
Yeah, that's nice. And obviously they love you because they keep electing you. So the northern border, I'm from San Diego, and even on the news, we talk a lot about the southern border. Can you give us a little bit of a picture of what's going on in the northern border? How is it the same, or how is it different than the southern border?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head. It's the same and it's different, right? It's the same in that the people that are coming, flowing across the northern border are from all over the world, right? I think just this year alone, over 91 countries represented by illegal migrants crossing the northern border that were...
Is it the same countries? Being in San Diego, I see patients... because they come to the emergency department after crossing the border. So we see all the countries, right? It's not South America. We see Haitians, Syria, Africa, all sorts of different areas. Is it the same people and they choose to go to Mexico versus to Canada?
You'd be surprised, but number one is the northern border is really getting hit hard by the number of illegal migrant crossings. It really is. I mean, it's up between 2021 and 2024, just this past year, it's up 600% from the numbers of 2021. And surprisingly, the number of Mexican nationals in that increase, up 1,000%. So there are people from Mexico going to Canada to come across the border because of the strengthening, especially more recently, the word that the southern border is going to be stronger. And that's concerning. You know, the southern border is difficult to secure. The northern border is extremely difficult to secure. Now, a lot of the encounters on the northern border are to the eastern side, right? So you're talking about New York, Michigan, you know, Great Lakes area. That's where the, you know, the biggest surge has been on the northern border. I find, and I think others do, we're optimistic. They're just opening the northern border mission control center, which is just outside of Detroit at Michigan Air National Guard base, to help coordinate security on the northern border. But, you know, again, it's very similar what we're seeing on the northern border. It's not the volume, but the number of people that are coming in, the surprising number of, you know, military aged Chinese nationals that are coming in, both in the northern and southern border. Why are they coming here? Could they have, you know, the number of people on the terrorist watch list that have already made it into our country? It's just, you know, when you think of the few number of terrorists that it took to carry out the 9/11 attacks, and then you think of the thousands and thousands and thousands of people that have been entered the U.S. illegally, but were released into the U.S. It's you hope they're really coming here for a good job and to support their family. But I think everybody in law enforcement and in this administration feels that that's probably not the case, and we have to be prepared and we have to secure our borders. I mean, the flow, you know, you focus a lot on drugs, and the flow of I can tell you in South Dakota, probably 90% plus of our methamphetamine, heroin, and fentanyl is coming from south of the border. Now, whether that's coming through the northern border or the southern border, either way, America and the world's drug market are basically focused on two Mexican drug cartels, right? So their reach is about through over 40 countries. And so it's not that it's just the U.S. It is their market. They run the drug control in a multitude of countries. And as such, they're going to be difficult target and difficult to intercept. And so securing our border is a huge first step. But
yeah, I remember you saying something like South Dakota, by the way, it is a beautiful state. I went there this summer with my parents, and we went to see the parks and Mount Rushmore and Badlands. It's gorgeous. Every American needs to go to. I think that's like one of the most iconic American places in the United States that most people don't visit. But I was struck by, this is not even North Dakota. We're South Dakota, and you consider yourself a border state, even though there's so many miles north of you, that's completely unguarded.
Yeah, you know, some of us are active with the Western State Sheriffs Association. One of our Western South Dakota sheriffs was the president of that. And so we've got to meet with the Western State Sheriffs. Too many of those are borders on the southern border, but also some of them on the northern border, in particular, you know, the northwest border. And they struggle with it. You know, unfortunately, Minnehaha County is a border county, right? And we face a threat both from the northern border, and we continue to face a huge threat from the southern border. So I remember sitting talking with the sheriffs. They were the border sheriffs of all the sheriffs that are on the southwest border. And they looked back at us in the room and they said, we will tell you something. The drugs and the human trafficking, the illegal criminal aliens are coming through our county not to our county, meaning they're coming to our county, right? And so unfortunately, every sheriff in America has become a border sheriff because of the threat from both our northern and our southern border.
And are you seeing, you know, we have the pictures kind of the southern border of like thousands of people crossing at the same time. And also, you know, an occasional, groups getting carried out and occasional bodies also, sadly, that somehow didn't make it. Are you seeing the same kind of thing in the northern?
I don't think they see that, you know, the caravans of people.
Yeah.
But, you know, what we worry about in particular is, and for some reason people ignore it, is the human tragedy with the children, you know, being trafficked, the sex trafficking. You know, you don't get across either border for free, right? So if you're going to come across the southern border, you're going to be paying money to come across. It could be $8,000 or $10,000. And if you don't have the money, you're going to owe them your body probably, right? You're going to you're going to be trafficked until you're paid up. So whether it's the northern border or southern border, we're all facing the same threat, and we're encouraged to hear the border is being, you know, secured, even using our military assets. Unfortunate that we have to get to that point, but we have no choice. It's the unprecedented flow of fentanyl and these deadly drugs that are made. Look, they, you know, and your listeners, viewers have heard this before, but China is a huge contributor to this problem. You know, this uninterrupted supply of fentanyl that comes into Mexico. Mexico drug cartels are key in this poisoning of Americans, over 100,000 in a year. With deadly fentanyl, they know what's coming into our country, and they know how it's getting here. And so we're going to have to look to whether it's sanctions or whatever it takes for this administration to shut off that flow, that unprecedented flow. We've never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
And how many people are being poisoned?
Shutting the supply. That's very key. Shutting the supply.
You see why I never get invited to speak to the Optimist Club?
I agree with you. Shutting the supply in a big way, that'll save the most amount of lives the fastest. But looking at this again, the picture of the northern border, we're now only a few days into the Trump administration, and we've seen some changes already. The Trump effect. What have you seen as far as our own assets, our own U.S. security at that border? Again, we're not going to be building a wall in the northern border, but what have we done on our end? And also we have news of Canada doing their part on their end.
Right. And, you know, Canada's struggling with the same issue in their country. I mean, the overdose, the drugs that Canada is experiencing, the number of cartels that, you know, they're going to have their hands and their fingers into Canada just like anywhere else. And so I think they'll be good partners in this effort. I can tell you in my own community, I can tell you I could drive up to our DEA office and the office is empty right now because they're working really hard on this, on directions coming out of both the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security. I saw my governor, who was just became the new DHS secretary. I saw her in the paper today on the streets of New York City, trying to round up some of these most dangerous.
That was an awesome picture, by the way. Yeah. She looked like a badass.
She does a good job, and she wants to take this challenge on. And I've had conversations both with her and Tom Holman, who was the drugs or the border czar with her. They're very determined to secure this border. And I can tell you, in talking with both of them, that they're taking this security of America very seriously. And they also understand clearly the impact that these drugs that are coming across the border, not only all the other things they talked about, the sex trafficking, the victimization of children, but these drugs are all coming through these cartels. I think the fact that they're designating the president has put in place a process to designate certain cartels as foreign terrorist organizations would think that's going to make them very, very nervous. Because if they're a foreign terrorist organization, we're allowed to use a lot of the three-letter agencies and the forces of the United States military to deal with the threats, whether they're within our country or elsewhere. So I would be nervous if I was actively leadership in one of those groups, if they become designated as foreign terrorist organizations. Look, they've killed hundreds of thousands of people, and there are people who have done much less, and or areas of countries that have done less that have been designated that way. So I'm hoping, we may be able to halt some of the flow of these drugs because we used to see our meth was being made locally. They break into a farmer's anhydrous tank and they do their own meth lab.
They don't bother with that anymore. It's cheap.
We have no meth labs. Why do it when it comes across the southwest border or the north border and it's so cheap? You know, the price has gone down. The potency has gone up. Interesting, in Sioux Falls and Minnehaha County, I have to talk to the coroner every month or so. About half of our overdose deaths are methamphetamine and about half are fentanyl. So it's kind of a mix here. We didn't used to have very many meth overdoses, but fentanyl and the opioids have certainly gathered strength. And running a 550-bed jail, booking 20,000 people into our jail every day, many of whom are addicted to meth or fentanyl, many of whom, you know, have mental health issues, they're self-medicating, they have co-occurring disorders, all those bad things in life. We're working hard to try to keep our inmate population safe, to try to direct resources to them.
I heard that you're also offering them treatment and using drug courts to keep them out of jail and kind of push them into treatment.
We are. We screen them. We screen them when they come in with medical staff. We look for people that would be good candidates for medication-assisted treatment. And if they are, we'll start that treatment in the jail. Then we work to try to get that treatment provided as they leave the jail upon release into the community. We've had overdose deaths in our jail. And so we now have, we spent, you know, a lot of money to have a full body scanner. It's almost like an open MRI that we can scan for contraband that they're bringing into the jail, in particular people who are turning themselves in, who know they're coming to jail. But one thing we're finding more and more is both men and women, heavy drug users, especially with fentanyl, they're carrying that inside a body cavity just as a matter of practice, right? In case they get stopped.
We get those in the emergency department. So we'll have law enforcement bring people from the jail to the emergency department because the scan was positive.
Right. We're seeing more and more of that. And so both with the scan and then we now invested in medical monitors that we actually put on people that are brought into custody. They're at high risk, extremely intoxicated or under the influence of drugs. Many of them are, because we don't know what they took. We don't know if they took fentanyl, how much did they take, what's their resistance to it.
Sometimes they don't know either.
We don't know, and they don't know. And so we put a medical monitor on them that tells us, and then our doctor in the jail sets a threshold. So if their heart rate goes below a certain threshold or above, if their oxygen level goes below or above, if their respirations go lower.
Wow. Remote medical monitoring.
It sends a warning to us, and we send our medical team there to try to intervene with it. So we want to keep these people alive. We want to get them into treatment. We've got were real big on low-risk offenders just being out of custody. Let them keep working. Let them stay with treatment. So we have what's called a 24/7 program. And I have more people being monitored today outside custody than I do the 550 people in jail. And that outside monitor could be, if it was an alcohol issue, they come in twice a day and blow on a portable breath test, or they have a portable unit that they facial recognition and do a breath test twice a day. If they've got drug issues, we do drug patches. We also do UAs every day. We do pretrial monitoring. So we have several hundred people that check in because we want to get them through their court process without having to linger in jail. So, you know, while, you know, we're focusing huge on the enforcement effort and supporting the securing of the borders, there's a lot of things we can do because of the fact that we house people, we supervise people for the courts, and in our own community, trying to put programs together to get them before they offend, before they come into the system. And so, you know, that even starts with like mentoring of high school students. You know, unfortunately, after COVID, the number of mentors available willing to work with kids have gone down at a time where there's been no bigger need for mentors to get these kids that have dysfunctional families, get them someone that you know, living a good life to try to help mentor them through these critical times. So it's much bigger than just what we're able to do with you know, making arrests, because we need to work on prevention. We need to work on treatment and certainly work on enforcement. And then I've been teaching junior achievement classes for a long time.
Hey, I did junior achievement. I didn't even know that was still around.
It is. And if I went to my fourth grade class, though, and if I showed them a map of North America and showed them where the drugs are coming from and said, okay, what's one of the first things that we could do to help impact all these illegal drugs that are killing our citizens? My fourth grade JA class would say, well, close these two areas off where they're all coming in, right? So that's what we're fortunately a much higher level.
Sheriff, that's all what I would say as a physician. Compassionate. That's all compassionate. Deterrence is compassionate. And then after you know, if you commit a crime, you get an opportunity to clean up and improve your health, and have compassionate justice. And I've met and had on this podcast so many people who've gone through the criminal justice program, and they thank them. They thank it for their life.
Well, yeah. In our 24/7 program, we've had people line up twice a day, and I mean they can do a test between 6 in the morning and 9 in the morning, and then 6 at night and 9 at night. And sometimes they're lined up in their pajamas and they're in their business suit, you know, and they'll turn around and say, look, this has changed my life. I needed something like this to get me back on course. And it really helps people. And if you're not caring and compassionate, if you just try to be the cop that enforces, you know, and goes after the drug dealers, look, we're going to be unsuccessful. It's going to be a disaster. So we have to be part of the whole circle, the whole prevention, you know, having treatment available. And then, you know, it's not easy to carry that on. You know, medication assisted treatment can be reasonably expensive or unreasonably expensive when you're out of custody. So trying to make sure we connect them with resources to keep them on the right road is huge.
Right. That's a big deal to continue insurance. And also, I'm thinking that if you're having methamphetamine, we're San Diego, we're ground zero to meth. Meth has always been higher than fentanyl in deaths, except for a few years where fentanyl was really flooding and mixing in the methamphetamine market. But even now, also, we have more methamphetamine deaths than fentanyl deaths, but most of them are combined.
The struggle, of course.
But there's no MAT for meth, and so there needs.
Right, there's no. That's our struggle. Is it? You know.
There's contingency management treatment, and you need to get that approved and implemented.
And then they need like 18 months, and then they need to be away from the people that they were hanging with. Yeah. And it's hard for somebody to just leave the jail or prison and go out and talk to nobody that you knew. So they instantly go back to their old friends, you know, and that who they got along with. And meth is so addictive.
Maybe I think Robert Kennedy's idea is to have, I forgot what the exact word was, but health farms where you go. I guess that's what helped him get clean, where you go to the communities where there are no drugs. And that's what we kind of need around the country. There's plenty of places to use drugs. I mean, there's always like talk about, oh, we need consumption sites or more sites. We don't need more sites to use drugs. We need more sites to stop drugs. That's what I have people leaving the emergency department crying because there's no place and all the places are full.
I think the safe injection site experiment was a huge failure, and I've driven through communities where they did that, and it's a disaster. And so I think you're right. I mean, I told this to governors, at least a couple of my governors over the years, if I was king, I'd put a inpatient treatment facility, correctional facility, so in custody inpatient facility out in the middle of nowhere, and it would be an alternative to prison if you were a nonviolent offender, and we're just going to need you to dry out, and then we need your brain to get healthy, and then we need to provide you with treatment, and then we need to work to make sure that when you come out, you still got a driver's license or an ID, so you can find a, you know, work with a landlord that is not part of the crime-free housing, so they're willing to take somebody in like that. Find them a mentor, an adult mentor, to, you know, and find them success. Because
a graduated program, right? Graduated program. First of all, you need to get your brain back, because you can't think when you're high like that. And it could take, you know, more than a month for you to be able to even think clearly and get your brain back. And then, you know, move up from there. In a reward-driven process. So, yeah, I think hopefully we'll get to see more of that.
And I'm a believer in specialty courts. You know, we launched in South Dakota. We piloted with another county the first drug court. Now we have drug court, DWI court, mental health court, veterans court. And we're active in all of those. The struggle with drug court and any of those specialty courts is that, so I'm going to use drug court as an example. One of my former chief deputy, who's my program manager, she's been active with it since day one, is I'll come by her office and she'll be in tears, and I'll know what it is, right? It's not anything with her family. It's that somebody they've been working on for a year and a half in drug court has failed, right? Is back in jail, kids taken away. And it's like she tells me, is it's like, when you have 15 well-connected people that are the volunteers to work with the drug court, right? You got judges, attorneys, you got police officers, you got leadership in the community, and these people can't make it. How would you ever stop using those drugs with no one? And that just helps magnify for me the difficulty it is for these people to get clean. Just really tough, especially with meth.
Yeah, it is definitely tough. National Sheriff Association, tell us now, what is important? What are the key issues that are important to the organization?
Well, National Sheriff's Organization represents, you know, over 3,000 elected sheriffs in the U.S. I've been active with them since I got on as sheriff, and so I'm on their board. And in particular, I'm fortunate that I chair the National Sheriff's Drug Enforcement Committee. So for me, I'm able to really focus not just on what's happening in Sioux Falls and Minnehaha County, but also nationwide. So it does allow me to connect with, you know, the administrator of Drug Enforcement Administration, the drug czar, whoever that may be, and work on some of our key priorities with National Sheriffs. Obviously with the volume of drug-related issues. There are a lot of best practices occurring out there within sheriff's offices across the country, and we listen for those. We listen to treatment providers. We listen to, you know, as we have our meeting, we've got one coming up in February. We'll have DEA there, top administration from DEA, to talk with us about their efforts and how we can coordinate. Obviously, there's a changing of the guard. So we'll, you know, we're hoping that we'll learn more about the border efforts and how we can support, in particular, some of the drug enforcement, the DEA things, and also support what their efforts are on the cartel influence in our communities. So it's a strong voice. We're headquartered out of Washington, D.C., so we have an executive director and great staff that will work the Hill when we have important legislation that, you know, we'll be watching legislation. We want to make sure and preserve things that we have and look at, you know, effective new ways that we can do, that we can actually do all three of the things you and I have just talked about, you know, that we can work, you know, what can we do as sheriffs on the prevention side? What can we do on the treatment and reentry side? And then what can we do to help on the enforcement side? And there are ways that we can do that. And one of them that I had a discussion with DEA Administrator Milgram with just a year or two ago was the one pill can kill. And then the overdoses that were, you know, like in a high volume of overdoses from fentanyl and the mass overdoses of fentanyl. And they wanted to get the word out. And I told Administrator Milgram, look, why don't you use the power of our associations, right? We've got International Association of Chiefs of Police. We've got the Association of State Criminal Investigative Agencies. We have all of these, you know, we have major county sheriffs, major city chiefs, these huge organizations that have great, you know, can really expand messaging. So that call with her was like at noon, and by 5 o'clock, she stopped the press and reissued a joint statement from all of our organizations on the problem with fentanyl. And it just showed how we could work together to try to expand the messaging nationwide and not just have something come as a quote news release from DEA. So we're, you know, with the new administration coming now, we're going to work to try to improve even more on joint messaging to get those messages out, whether that's on treatment, whether that's getting help, whether that's on prevention, whether it's on mentoring, whatever it could be that we could help try to impact this scourge.
I heard some specific requests that are important to you, too. We did a whole episode about the de minimis loophole that I know you said is important to you. Canine programs, right? I think that I've heard mentioned is important to Sheriff. Is that right?
Right. And, you know, let me just touch on de minimis, for example. I mean, and maybe in case somebody didn't listen to what you talked earlier in an earlier program about, for crying out loud, you know, the loop, it used to be expensive to send things from overseas into the U.S. So there wasn't a volume of coming into the U.S. And if you think about a package that is shipped from China or India or wherever into the U.S., it's now become very inexpensive to do that. And the de minimis loophole allows someone from those countries to ship a package directly into the U.S. and they don't pay a tariff on it. They don't pay taxes on it. And we are not able to adequately screen any of those packages, right? And the reason is the volume. So just today, right? Just today, 3 million packages arrived in the U.S. for distribution as de minimis, right? Under that, they came from every country in the world, and we don't know what's in them. But we do know that some of the things that are in them, it's going to be fentanyl. Some of it's going to be pill presses. It's going to be, and even if you get away from the drug side, it can be stuff that violates every trade agreement we would have with other countries about our textile industry, about our prescription drugs. Could be counterfeit prescription drugs from another country. Somebody thinks they're getting a good deal. It's not going through FDA. We have no idea what they are. And so we have urged, National Sheriffs has urged the incoming administration and the former administration to close that de minimis loophole. I can say that in our conversation with the transition team that I had just a few weeks ago, they're well aware of the problem. I don't know if we'll see something come right away, but it looks to me like the White House isn't in a slow mode right now. So we're hoping to see some work, both whether that's through the White House or Congress. We'd like to see that closed because it's Pandora's box. Quite frankly, we don't know what's coming into our country. 3 million packages every day, a billion a year.
And even she said 4 million, up to 4 million now. That's obviously important. Fentanyl detection equipment, because, you know, I read about the Canadians using now, bringing in the fentanyl detection across on their end, and I'm sure that you are wanting some more of that on our end as well.
Right. You know, CBP is the ones that, let's just talk about the de minimis packages. We're working and encouraging better screening equipment to be able to rapid screen those packages. There's also other things that they could do, and that is go back to having a broker that takes these packages, that is a licensed, trusted broker within the U.S. that it's like almost like a wholesaler, I would call it, so that you have someone from the U.S. that has, you know, that has rules they have to follow, and part of those would be screening. We have to improve our screening of our own packages being shipped by UPS, FedEx, the U.S. Postal Service. And, you know, you can make it fentanyl specific, but then think about what else we have coming down the line. I mean, we're seeing an increase in car fentanyl, 100 times more potent than fentanyl. Now we're seeing car fentanyl at a higher level. We're looking at xylazine or Trank. You know, if you want to just lose your appetite, go Google xylazine or the Trank or the zombie drug and look what it does to people. Not only, and we are seeing xylazine now in every state in the union, in particular the East Coast, up into Ontario, xylazine, British Columbia, is rapidly spreading. And what it is, you know, it's a veterinarian tranquilizer. Narcan has no effect on it. But on the East Coast, they're finding it in 85% of the powdered Narcan, or of the powdered fentanyl coming into the U.S. 85% of it also has xylazine. Well, yeah. Narcan doesn't work. It's not a scheduled drug. Spreading all over, and they use it because it enhances the effect of the drug, right? So if you go to Philadelphia and you buy meth, heroin, fentanyl, I don't care what you buy, it'll have xylazine in it. And you get these wounds that just start like a pimple, and ultimately it looks like flesh-eating bacteria. A lot of amputations that result, a lot of open wounds on half the face or arms or legs. It's horrible. We have to be able to detect more than just fentanyl. So it's a challenge, but we got to be aware of the xylazine, because it is in a city near you, I will guarantee it.
Yeah. It'd be interesting where it is, how it is in your area. We monitor that like monthly. In San Diego, we do not have the amount, I mean, it's been detected, but it's not in the same potency as the East Coast, and not at all in the same amount. And the wounds, we have wounds. We've, you know, again, I've told you we're the meth ground zero for methamphetamine for the country. So we've seen those wounds because of methamphetamine.
We're kind of in the same shape. We were, DEA was going to announce just several months ago that South Dakota was the only state in the union that didn't have xylazine in their drugs, and then they found it. So we're at the early entry stage, but we've already gone to our jail medical provider, and their doctors and nurses have studied what to watch for with this on people that are in our custody, how to treat it. Some of it isn't really treatable, but if it's recognized early. But what we're learning from is the East Coast. And so we know that it's the fact that it enhances the effect and it increases the weight of the drug that you're selling is it's a strictly a business venture for people that are in that market, and it's almost no cost. Xylazine is, I mean, it's so cheap and unregulated that, you know, our state put in a xylazine bill, so we've got at least a state law that covers it, but it's dangerous, and so we're trying to get ahead of that.
What does your state law say about it?
It's made it illegal unless you're a veterinarian. We wanted to keep, it's a very important tranquilizer commonly used by veterinarians. So we wanted to keep the vets to have good access to it, but not for the regular people. Now, one good note on xylazine and veterinarians is vets use the liquid form of xylazine.
And not the powder.
What we're seeing on the East Coast and elsewhere is it's a powdered form. And the vets say, well, we don't even use that. So it makes it easier to write state legislation on it.
Yeah. So President Trump said that there'll be drug cartels labeled foreign terrorist organization. Hope that will help your deterrence and power to go after this source of evil in our country. And one of the other things that we've kind of been promoting that hasn't been said yet by the president is declaring fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction to go after fentanyl itself. I mean, xylazine is bad, but it's not going to kill you the instant you just, you know, put a pill on your mouth like fentanyl can. But if we declare fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction, then the consequences and deterrence for that one killer will be much greater.
Well, you know we stand behind that, obviously, and you know I stand behind it. I think I would speak for a lot of sheriffs to say every one of us are seeing the number of deaths in our own community, people we know or people whose children, lost their lives. This is a weapon of mass destruction. It's a drug, but if you look at what have been considered weapons of mass destruction in the past, this has claimed far more victims. And I certainly would stand behind.
Well, we should talk because Families Against Fentanyl is really into pushing for fentanyl to be declared a weapon of mass destruction. And if the National Sheriff Association would sign off about that, I think that'll help.
Well, if you can get my Drug Enforcement Committee a resolution, I can work on that next week.
All right, I'll do that. Yay! Podcast action, right in front of everybody. Sheriff Mike, what's your message to the president, and what's your message to the American people?
Well, my message is: look, if you've got a family member or a friend that you think is struggling with drug addiction, in particular, going down this road of fentanyl or meth, it's not the way it started. I mean, if we think of when it used to be they'd steal their grandmother's prescription, maybe take a few pills and sell them.
Those were the good old days. I call that those were the good old days when the doctor was the drug supplier.
Yeah, exactly. It's different now. And fentanyl, you know, we call a lot of them accidental poisonings or intentional poisonings. More and more, we're seeing addicts that are intentionally knowing that fentanyl is their drug of choice. Right? They're looking for fentanyl pills, The one pill can kill campaign. Nothing could be true. I mean, it's true. That's exactly what it can happen. And so we have to focus on fentanyl. And if you've got someone in your family or you're worried about someone, get them help, right? So I don't want to see them in jail. I want you to get, and don't be afraid to mentor kids that are living in troubled homes and dysfunctional families. Be out front. I'll work on dealing with enforcement, right? I'll work on those ends, but we need to try to focus more help on the front end before they commit the crimes that they are. for the president.
Yeah, and the front end, let me just add that that's like in middle school, addiction charts in middle school. So we need to start kids when they're little, when they're not using drugs, to protect their brain and want to lead a healthy life. And I think it needs to start there. And law enforcement has a great role there.
And the struggle is, Dr. Lou, I mean, one of the struggles is there's so many new things coming down the pipe right now. All the vapes that are now in the U.S. coming from overseas, we don't even know where, from China, India, wherever they may be coming, Mexico. We don't know what's in them. The FDA hasn't approved anything in them. And they're and you go down, you drive down a street, and there's middle school kids that are...
No. Our children, I said our children now are the lab rats.
So, you know, we're working right now on a law in South Dakota. The legislature's actually next week working on one of our house bills to try to restrict vapes and make it so that they would have to have gone through an FDA approval process. We're hoping we can get that passed. Federally, we need something with some teeth to it, but there's just so many moving targets out there. You know, we have the intoxicating hemp products that are flooding the markets and unregulated because of the farm bill that they've, you know, well, some of those hemp products, whether it's something that you drink or something that you take some of them are extremely potent, high THC, but they're kind of exempt under that. And we don't know, there's no regulation on them. You can sell them at a Kool-Aid stand as a 7-year-old. So you got to kind of, I guess when I...
Do you know what the number one cause of poisoning of children, babies in America is? Marijuana.
Oh, I can believe that.
Marijuana, gummies, and we even did the research of where they get it from. They get it from their parents.
Right. And some of these hemp products, we have to really be careful and watch that. You know, we want to protect the farm bill, but the farm bill was not intended to flood the markets like it has with high potency hemp-related intoxicants. I mean, there's some of them. I have a friend who drank a 16-ounce bottle of one of these Delta 9 hemp naturally occurring, quote, said it was like drinking a 6-pack of beer. One of them.
And it's also not natural. We've had the FDA look at it, and there's no way that you can, you know, collect so much hemp to make those Delta 9 products. They're all synthetically made.
But they get around the farm bill. But either way, I mean, so the reason I'm pointing about talking about all those other things that are out there is, look, if you got a grandson, a neighbor kid, a nephew, whatever it may be, that you're starting to see take on these addictive vapes or some of the hemp products, they're climbing a ladder, right? And real quickly, they're going to experiment with something that could kill them, right? That's when that fentanyl hits them. One pill can kill. It will. And so you've got to act on the front end. And on the back end, I act, right? And that's enforcement. That's our county jail. That's talking to the coroner. That's going to somebody and knocking on their door and telling them that their son or daughter is never coming home again. So that's the impact it can have. So if you have a chance to take an impact and have an impact on a kid's life now, do that. And you ask what I would tell the president, it's like, you know, stay a steady course in high gear. Because we need that. We need to shut the supply off. We need to work on the demand. We need to support programs on all three of those legs of that stool. But we've got to shut off and we've got to close down those that are bringing these poisons into our country. And if that's because they're foreign terrorist organization or because you declare it a weapon of mass destruction, God bless you.
That's great. Yeah, prevention, treatment, supply. Sheriff Mike Milstein, thank you so much for your work, your service through multi-generations, protecting our northern border and representing National Sheriff Association.
Thank you, Dr. Lev.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.